Wave Farm, and I'm Tom Rowe, and Heidi Nielsen is here.
Hello.
Hello, there you are, yes.
Here I am. Am I there?
You are there.
I am here.
You have been the artist in resident all week at Wave Farm, and you just spent several hours today teaching a workshop full of folks learning how to make an antenna, FM receiving antenna, suited to receive the WGXC signal. And you've been pointing microphones at satellites in the sky and all kinds of other things this week at Wave Farm. Is any of that correct?
All of that's correct. Yeah, I've also been diving into Wave Farm's library here, which has been excellent. In just a few minutes, I'm kind of eyeing the clock at 4:16. We are going to hear a transmission, if everything goes right, from...
There's a satellite about to pass overhead?
There's a satellite about to pass overhead. It's a NOAA satellite.
So this is where we get our weather radar, satellite images?
Exactly, yeah. So it continuously photographs the surface of the Earth and transmits the image down as a radio signal. So we're going to receive the radio signal through that antenna out there, which you can kind of see through our window. It's
if you stare hard through your radio, you can see
it. You can see out our window. It's an antenna that's circular. It has a very omnidirectional quality to it. It's basically two loops that are twisted, so it kind of looks like a DNA strand or something. And it's mounted on a PVC pipe, which is strapped on top of a ladder. And so we have a cable going from that up through the window into the studio and then into a dongle. It's called a FunCube dongle, which is basically a radio, software-defined radio, that's then plugged into my computer. So I'm looking at the radio signal from that antenna on a waterfall, so I can see the image of the radio signals as kind of a graph, and then below that there's kind of an image of the recent history of that, which will... I don't know, it's just a way of visually showing the...
And what kind of frequencies are these that the satellites use?
So this is 137.9125 megahertz. There's three NOAA satellites that are doing this, and they are right around that frequency, like 137 point something or other megahertz. It's 4:12 now, so we have about 3 minutes.
3 or 4 minutes to get ready for the satellite. Everybody, mm-hmm. Put on your aluminum caps.
Yep.
Because the satellites are... there is a satellite passing overhead, we're going to see if we can hear it in just a minute or two more. So are you're all set up? Do we have to do anything first?
Or? Well, I just keep like running over my checklist. It's plugged in. I can see it running. I have... things set properly, I believe.
I think you were telling me the other day it sends you a photograph?
Yeah, so it sends the radio signal, and so I have the radio, my software-defined radio is decoding that as audio, right? So I'm seeing that as audio, and then we run it through another program that will basically, it's like a fax program where it changes the image from an audio to a visual to an image. It's like,
oh, there,
a fax.
It's coming through, yeah.
So that's kind of like what we're listening to, but it's the same idea. And usually, what I do is make the signal go directly into this other program, so you can visually see the image appearing. But for now, because it's radio, we're listening to the sound.
All right, and so it looks like another minute or two before the. Satellite passes overhead, so it's maybe behind the mountain right there now?
It could very well be, yeah. So it will rise at 4:16, and it takes about 10, maybe 11 minutes for it to go by, and sometimes it does take a second for it to actually show up after the 4:16 because of the mountains or other obstructions like that.
And... the weather, this radio satellite might be busy today or might have an eye full, since there are, it seems like there are storms on the way. It looks like there are storm-like clouds in the distance.
It's true. It's atmospheric for getting an eye from the top.
Now, does that help? Does that kind of weather conditions help or hinder reception?
I don't think the weather conditions really matter for the reception. I did once have this next to a solar array, and so I noticed that when it was really, really sunny and the solar array was feeding back into the grid, I would get a lot of interference because of that electric. So I would get really nice clear images in the rain. Like when it was pouring down rain, the images would be nice and clear because that interference was knocked out. But no, I don't suppose it usually matters.
All right, so 4:15. All right, so 4:16 is when the satellite is supposed to pass overhead. So we'll be hearing it momentarily. So we're plugged in. If you can tell me, and I'll turn you on when we think it's time.
Yeah. So pretty soon I will start seeing the signal. And actually, I can almost. Maybe I'm just imagining things. But it starts looking like kind of like a comb, like a wide tooth comb starts kind of bouncing around. So it's like several signal fingers, sort of.
That's the static we're hearing now.
That's the static? Oh, so we're, this is from...
I think it's live.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's it. Let's see if I can narrow the bandwidth a little. I'm getting a lot of them.
So you can... You can start to hear it now.
Yeah.
It's getting more particular. Right, you can hear it very, very clearly. brain, that's literally disappearing beyond the horizon. Is that what's happening?
It's literally disappearing beyond the horizon. That's it.
I think we've lost it now, right?
Yeah, we have. I can see still the faintest signals, but they're fading fast. That was NOAA 18, and it was northbound, so it's heading off towards the poles, North Pole.
Huh, so the mountains may not have affected. It may have split through, or I guess it would have. It's from the south. It was coming from south to north, so it probably started late.
Yeah, it started a little late. So yeah, I have that recorded, and later on I'll run it through the other program and see it as an image.
And so this week at Wave Farm, this is what you've been doing. You've been pointing your antennas at celestial bodies.
That's right, yeah. So I brought a few antennas, and I've been tracking satellites and recording what I can find. And I've been doing this as kind of a way of interacting with space as a landscape, like as a way of sort of trying to detect space and think of space as continuous landscape with what you can see on Earth. And so I've been looking a lot about how, as an individual, one can do that. And one way is through radio, through listening. And I've also been kind of simultaneously researching individuals who are directly involved in space research. So there's this whole CubeSat movement that I can talk about. But for today, I have for you a few of the transmissions that I've recorded, and I have also I've kind of divided into sections of transmissions recorded from space, and then space bounces. So like our own recordings reflected back to ourselves, and how various people have used that in art and other contexts. So
it's kind of like basketball for radio or something.
Yeah.
People literally send a signal up at the moon and hope that it bounces back so they can hear it.
Yeah, off the moon, off of other satellites, off of meteors. I have a clip in here. Basically any, you know, bouncing off the ionosphere, like really anything that a radio wave can bounce off of. I have. Would you like to hear? So we just heard basically a contemporary transmission, you know, one that happened today.
Live.
I have a few historic satellites as a comparison. Want to hear that?
Sure, yeah. Do you have satellites, do they sound different over time? Or is this early technology that's going to be much more primitive? Or what are we about to hear?
Well, we're about to hear some of the earliest satellites from 1957 through 1961. And these are recorded. A couple of them are from NASA, and a lot of them are from ham radio operators. And many of them were by a ham radio operator, Roy Welsh, WSL. And there's a compilation site, Matthias, DD1US, he has a website, DD1US.de. So he's compiled a whole bunch of, like, space history sounds. So so here we are. This is about a minute of different satellites, and I've announced each one kind of like bird calls or something. Oh, you know what?
Have the other one going?
Yeah, I sure do. Yep.
All right, it's bubbling there. I hear it.
Okay.
Let's just dry that off there.
Should I try this one from this top?
All right, try it now, yeah.
Okay.
I think most of the water's out of it.
I think it's playing. Here we go. Explorer 1.
So there were monkeys making that noise?
Was a few of the few historic satellites.
And you were saying that the first one was Sputnik, the first Russian satellite that orbited the Earth in 1959. Is that
nine? Yeah.
I don't know. It caused Kennedy to say we're gonna get to the moon, so it had to be around 1960-ish.
Yeah. So yeah, I think of it as an odd year.
And there was a monkey driving the ship. Is it?
I think was a later Sputnik, and okay. I think it was a dog, wasn't it? Laika?
I thought there was a monkey at one point. Or is that just Lancelot Link I'm thinking of?
The monkeys might have come a little later. So yeah, that was just sort of a comparison of some of the old satellites with new ones. And I have a few that I've recorded since being here. Here's the International Space Station. All right, that was the International Space Station on the Saturday afternoon show, and we're talking to Heidi Nielsen, who's been recording sounds from outer space all week. That's right. So, yeah, that was the International Space Station. That was data coming from the space station. You, or one, can also hear voices. There's a few of the astronauts aboard the space station have ham radio licenses, and so they can talk to people. Sometimes when they happen to be, in their spare time going by, the astronauts are on a Moscow time, so there's something like 8 hours ahead of us, and they tend to talk in what is their early morning. So it's kind of coordinating when they might be active with when we're active as well, and they're not always doing it, you know, talking either. So so it's kind of when you can actually hear voices from them, it's sort of a big treat, actually.
And I think that there's a special ham radio days or something. They often the field days and stuff. They often do specific.
They'll schedule something in particular. Yeah, exactly. So that's pretty cool. I have another satellite called PCSat, which I can play here. It has a different sound to it. So yeah, that was PCSat, and that PC is Prototype Communications Satellite, and to me that one sounds, it's very faint, and it sounds much more like the twanging of a rubber band or something, you know. So I have been following a lot this satellite called FunCube. It's a CubeSat from the UK.
And what is a CubeSat?
Yeah, so a CubeSat, it's basically a format. It's this kind of new format where they're cubes, they're little boxes that are 4 inches on a side, 10 centimeters on a side, and so they're extremely modular, and you can do a whole lot. It's very flexible on the interior, whatever you put in this modular box, and it makes it, because of this modular format, and they're able to sort of gang them up together in small groups and send them as payloads to, for example, the International Space Station, and they'll store them there a while, and then you can launch them out the door of the International Space Station in different sections. And so it's a way of making space exploration very accessible to schools, to smaller groups, almost down to the individual level. And so I've been following that. So the FunCube is basically an educational program. It has a whole dashboard that you can download, and comes with it that free software that will track it, will like help you track it. The idea is to make it accessible for classrooms so that teachers can very easily like track the satellite. And it has an online resource where when you receive the signal, it will show you how many packets you collected and that sort of thing online. In any case, I've been following it, and so I have a couple of recordings from it. So here is one of those.
Thank you.
Nori, that was much more dynamic, huh?
Yeah. So yeah, that was the fun cube, and as sort of a representative of this whole class of cube, this cube satellite business. So to kind of further investigate the whole realm of CubeSats, I contacted this one of the small groups that's investigating them, that made one, and I talked to him earlier this week, and I recorded the conversation, so I have that to play. It's an interview with Carl Brandon. He's the principal investigator, and he's a professor of science and aeronautical engineering at Vermont Technical College. So his project is called CubeSat Lunar Lander / Orbital Project. So here's my talking with
and
him.
And this is going to take us up into the 5 o'clock hour, it looks like?
It will. It's about 15 minutes or so. You could kind of stop it if you like.
We'll just tell our listeners that this is what we'll hear for now, and then we'll be back on the Saturday afternoon show a little after 5.
Okay. Here it is.
We have a ground station at Vermont Tech another piece of software which uses the same information. We'll operate our antennas and have them track the satellites. They're always pointing at the satellite when you come by. And also tunes the radio for us to adjust for Doppler shift. This thing's moving 70,000 miles an hour.
So do you then give it commands to do different things as it's passing by? I noticed that it has a camera on it. So do you, in order to operate the camera, for example, do you have to like give it a command in order to do that? Or do you need to command it to give you data? Or how does that work?
Either one. So we can ask for data, and the data that we've been getting so far is from an inertial measurement. It gives us rotation rates and acceleration rates and magnetic field in all three axes. A lot of that is sent off in the beacon. So the satellite, every couple of minutes, just sends a little packet of data down with its identifier. And so various ham radio people around the world will collect those and email that data to us. And then the more specific data, it stores the stuff on an SD card like your camera would. And then we ask it to send it down when the satellite's in range. We give it a command to download the files. So we'll send up a command and say, take a dozen pictures. And then it takes, every few minutes it takes another picture. And then stores them. And then we download the pictures. Typically out of a dozen, you'll get two or three that are nice pictures. The others just out in the space or in the sun or something. Not very interesting. So we have a pretty good collection, and I haven't sat down and put them all together. I'm guessing we have about 25 really nice pictures now.
Wow.
And so we have, as you asked about the team, we have a very small team. There are, now at the moment, there's me, and then a faculty member, Peter Chapin, who was in charge of the software development, but he was not available for the critical last 3 months because he was finishing up his PhD dissertation. And then I have a former student, Bill McGrath, who's the CEO of LED Dynamics, which is one of the highest tech LED companies in the world that's located in Randolph, right down the hill from us. And he has a ground station at his house, and he's actually been downloading all the pictures. But he has to do it sort of manually. So we're a week ago, Saturday, he was up at the school with me, and we were sort of cooking things together in the ground station up there. We have a little bit more work to do, but then we should be able to have it totally automated, so it will, on its own, ask for the picture files to be downloaded and collect them. And, usually when you download a file, it's missing a couple of packets, and you have to ask for those. This will do that automatically, so we don't have to have them sitting there all the time.
So all of that's happening really fast, right? Because it goes by, in about 10 or 15 minutes, right? So
yeah, typically about 10 minutes is the most time you have contact.
Yeah, and so basically all of this coordination has to happen within just a few minutes. You have to know when it, where exactly it is, then...
Yes, we look at the tracking software, and then we'll look ahead and see, okay, tonight at 8:15 it'll be available, and then at 9:45 it'll be available, and so on. And then we can plan to, for at the moment it's been bill that goes to his ground station and listens for the satellite beacon, or when it's in range. Actually, he doesn't listen to it. He waits till it's supposed to be in range, and he sends it a command and listens for the response. And, you know, that's usually an initial one, just asking for a response. And then when you get a response, then you ask it to download data. You know, you're in contact with it. So that's basically the way we operate it. And in the future, we hope to do it in an automated fashion. And the other thing, I need to look ahead and see when, after dark, but not in the middle of 2 a.m. times, it will be passing by. Because one of those times in the past, I could see from the tracking software, it was going to pass right in front of the star Sirius. So I aimed at my telescope. I have a 10-inch telescope in Sirius, and I knew exactly when it was going to go by Sirius. And I watched, and I could see it. See a very dim little satellite track going right where we're supposed to go.
Wow.
So that was pretty exciting to actually see it.
So you're seeing it, wow. So you're seeing it as reflected light, or does it have an LED on board?
It does have LEDs, but at that point, I was looking at the reflected sunlight. If you look about an hour after sunset, sort of ideal time, because the satellites are still pretty much in the sunlight, and yet it's fairly dark. And so that's, if you have a pass that's at that time, it's ideal to see it without the LEDs. Then the other thing, which I have to do, the next time it's going to be at a reasonable dark hour, I'm going to put my camera on the telescope, and it flashes LEDs periodically, but it's every few minutes. So unless you're actually tracking the satellite with the telescope, which is the other thing I have to do with my telescope, is I have to hook up my software to track the satellite, which I have the stuff to do that, but I haven't been around to it yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And then take a picture of it so I can get the LEDs flashing. And the other option is to just have it fixed like I did before, and Bill McGrath will then send it a command to flash the LEDs fairly rapidly. And I should be able to see it that way. They'll be readily available, and I'd like to really get that on camera, on, you know, as an image that I captured, so I can put that on the website. That would be pretty neat.
Yeah.
Here's our satellite lights.
Yeah, that's really fantastic to be able to actually see the thing. That's amazing. So I know, so you were talking a little bit about the how to track it, and I see on your website that the information is available to ham radio people, and I've been tracking some satellites myself. I'm a ham, and I've been participating in the FunCube project, where you collect.
Yep.
So I have a FunCube dongle, and I am tracking with like an Arrow antenna and a couple.
A pretty good signal. We were actually the first of our launch to be heard from, with a handheld Arrow antenna in the parking lot at Wallops Island, with a FunCube dongle and a laptop.
Oh, fantastic!
So works. And I've actually listened to it walking across campus with a FunCube. It wasn't even a FunCube dongle. It was one of these $18 dongles.
right.
And the Arrow two-band antenna.
Uh-huh.
I was just walking across the campus with a software-defined radio app on my tablet. And that worked. It's not hard to do it, but the beacon is only, every couple of minutes. So you got to sort of, you basically have to take your antenna, sort of figure out, looking at the tracking software, okay, it's going to become visible in the southwest at this time, and it's going to go across and disappear in the southeast at this time, and you have to just try to estimate where it is. That's what I did with the handheld antenna. But you can do that. That'll work.
So the beacon is only transmitting every couple of minutes, and so that might be,
right.
So it's not a continuous thing, and it's just the beacon. So, but if I happen to intercept it when you guys have already commanded it to.
Well, no, the beacon will be on all the time.
All the time, okay.
Yeah. If we've commanded it to send out more stuff, then it'll be frequent back and forth stuff that you might also get. But, you know, the way to tell when that is a possibility is to see when it's on one of its northernmost passes. You know, usually about 3 passes in a row where its altitude is, 30 degrees or more above the horizon. Those are really good contact ranges. So it will vary between 30 and 50 on those 3 passes. And that's likely when Bill's going to try to download something. It's running this very busy company, too, so it doesn't always happen.
Yeah. It's.
But he put they did the LEDs for our satellite, and they have LED lighting on the space station, and they had it on the space shuttle.
So how have you had a lot of people sending you, ham radio people sending you data? Like, is it a...
But we get a few, every once in a while we get some. I've had them from South America, from Italy, from Australia, from Japan, from Spain, You know, it's sort of fun.
That's
somebody's
really
all over the pigments, yeah.
That's fantastic. Have you thought about doing it in a more, I mean, like, for example, the FunCube project is very much about that. You know, they have this whole dashboard and they've made it really easy for people to be able to do it. Is that something that you've thought about doing? I mean, I know it's a whole other sort of wing to your project.
Well, we can't, you know, there are two things. The data that's sent out automatically, you know, people can listen to it. It's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's not that much they have to do except, you know, get the tracking information and I need to update on our website, but you know, anybody can search on the Air Force database and get the tracking information, and you can listen to that. We are not in a position to let people send commands up because we have commands that can cause problems if somebody didn't know what they were doing. Commands.
Yeah, totally.
They go off and, yeah. So we don't do that. I mean, you could, and I haven't looked at the details of the dashboard and what they allow you to do with FunCube. But they may have done that. You know, you can set it up so that people can send commands, and those commands are perfectly safe.
Uh-huh.
And you have a separate command structure that people operate that allow. So we might do that for the next one.
Uh-huh.
We didn't do that.
Just to kind of get like a whole project overview, this is like the second CubeSat in like a 3 series, right? Like you did a previous one that was more of a test of the CubeSat kits, and that was going to the Alaskan Ice Buoy project, and then this is kind of the second one of that. The third one is going to the moon. Is that right?
Third one is it's going to be a spacecraft that is capable of going to the moon, but we're likely to launch the next one in low Earth orbit to test everything it would use going to the moon, just because those launches are much, much easier to get than one from which you could go to the moon, and the launches from which you. You know, the launches, if you had to pay for one to low Earth orbit with a triple CubeSat, which that would probably be under $400,000. We, in fact, got a free launch. So, you know, you can't say there's no such thing as a free launch. It's that one. And we're hoping to get low Earth orbit. And if, you know, we're in a good position since we have a working satellite, and no one else did in our group, and if we do the next one to low Earth orbit, we're very likely to get a free launch to a lunar departure orbit, a communication satellite launch orbit. So that would be really nice. So it's also, you know, less risky and easier to do if you're in low Earth orbit. The communication's easy and all that stuff. So we're likely to do that. Build something that could go to the moon with an ion drive, but then use it in low Earth orbit, use the ion drive to change the orbit a number of times, just get experience with all that.
So how does the satellite that's in orbit now differ from the one that you're thinking about, like a prototype for going to the moon?
This is a single CubeSat, so it's a 10-centimeter cube, a 4-inch cube, and the next one would be a triple CubeSat, so it would be 10 by 10 by 30 or 4 by 4 by 12 inches. And it would have an ion drive, so it would be self-propelled, and a big fold-out photovoltaic panel to 56-watt panel probably to power the ion drive, which uses a lot of electricity.
Wow, okay.
So that would be those two things. Oh, and then it would have an active attitude determination and control. We're just using passive, which is just magnets to line up with the Earth's magnetic field. So those are the two sort of big technical things, the ion drive and the active orientation system.
And, you know, on your website you've mentioned landing on the moon or sending the same, orbiting the moon and then sending that same satellite toward Mars. Do you have other thoughts or plans on that?
The landing on the moon was something that I came up with this idea initially, and we got a big grant to look at those technologies in 2009. And to actually land something on the moon, now you're carrying volatile, explosive, flammable propellants, and to get a communication satellite is very difficult. So, you know, it might be a neat thing to try, but it's probably not a practical thing to put our efforts into. And better to do something that'll orbit the moon that doesn't have those kind of issues.
Yeah.
And much easier to think technically, and then you have more space in the satellite for instruments and so on for studying. So that's the way we'll probably go. And it's just that this thing would have enough ion drive capability that it could go to the moon and orbit the moon for a few months and then go to Mars, orbit Mars. So anyway, that's a possibility.
Wow, that's really great, and that's kind of the long term plan after, because the current satellite that's in orbit will stay there for a few years, right?
Yeah, a couple of years. It's hard to tell exactly. It depends on solar activity and which piece of software used for predicting it, because they vary quite a bit. Because you're predicting something way out in the future with very, very low drag, and it's very hard to predict accurately.
So in terms of your like development of each of these projects, you kind of have this one going while you're thinking about the next one and planning launches and so forth, and then incrementally ramping up these different things. Yeah. Are you keeping the camera capability on the moon orbiting?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll probably have several cameras on that to do more sophisticated studies with the camera. So one of the people that I'm working with is the photometrist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab at Caltech, and he'll help us pick cameras for the next one. We'll have several of them. So the old cameras will be used for navigation and for studying.
So the navigation. So you mean it would have some kind of mapping capability with the images? Is that what you mean?
Yes. Yeah. So it would use the images for navigation, as well as when it's near enough to the Earth, GPS. We have GPS on this current one.
Okay. Well, wow, that sounds like a fantastic project. I'm really excited for you guys. I mean, it's an amazing accomplishment, actually, for just a handful of people to do.
I still can't believe it, that we pulled it off. Because there's no way with the few number of people we had that we should have been able to do it.
Yeah, that's that's really impressive.
All right, you're listening to the Saturday Afternoon Show. I'm Tom Rowe. Live from Wave Farm, and one programming note. Tonight, live from the Spotty Dog Books and Ale in Hudson, after 8 o'clock, Liv Caro, Tongue Oven, and Black Sky perform. We'll be joining that later. Right now, you're listening to the Saturday Afternoon Show. I'm Tom Rowe at the Wave Farm with Heidi Nielsen, who's been listening to transmissions from outer space last hour, and this hour is going to listen to some bouncing transmissions from Earth to space and back. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So we just were talking about CubeSats, and I was talking to
Carl Brandon.
Carl Brandon, thank you. About the CubeSat project at Vermont Technical College, and so now we're turning attention to things that to transmissions which bounce off of things from outer space. So the first one that I have queued up here is from Project Echo, which was the first satellite. It was a big, huge Mylar balloon that was an experimental satellite to use the idea of bouncing things off of this satellite as a communications project, as a big communications effort. So here's a section from a documentary on that, where it has the first voice communication bounced in space. So here we go.
Transmission bounced off a man-made satellite will be from tape recordings. Goldstone has just reported they have picked up the balloon. A pinpoint in the sky, 100 feet wide, 1,000 miles out in space. Like trying to locate a golf ball a mile away.
We have it now, Bill.
Good. Let's hope we can keep it. The signal looks good, Luke. Tracking looks good, too. Let's see how Goldstone is doing. Hello, Goldstone. This is Holmdel. We're getting your signal. How are you receiving ours?
Strong and steady, Bill.
Fine, fine. Okay, here we go. We're going to start our tape now, and you start yours.
This is President Eisenhower speaking. It is a great personal satisfaction to participate in this first experiment in communications involving the use of the satellite balloon known as Echo. This is one more significant step in the United States program of space research and exploration. The program is being carried forward vigorously by the United States for peaceful purposes for the benefit of all mankind. The satellite balloon, which has reflected these words, may be used freely by any nation for similar experiments in its own interest. Information necessary to prepare for such participation was widely distributed some weeks ago. The United States will continue to make freely available to the world the scientific information acquired from this and other experiments in its program of space exploration.
It really sounds good here, Walt.
Fine, Bill.
And so the first spoken word from man through space to his own satellite and back to man again is the voice of the President of the United States. And as the satellite sweeps swiftly out of range, further transmission must wait for another passage. Now, sometime later, as the balloon again passes over America, the same scientists try the first telephone conversation ever bounced from a man-made satellite.
You can fire up the transmitter.
Right.
Hello, Goldstone. This is Holmdel calling. Calling Goldstone.
How do you read me?
Holmdel, this is Goldstone.
You're loud and clear, Bill.
Oh, wonderful. Well, it looks like all the hard work was really worth it.
A new bold stride on a long road has been taken. The road to communications between ourselves and others overseas with the same variety and dependability we now enjoy anywhere in our own country. The balloon satellite of Project Echo is, of course, for experiment only. But it is an experiment that may result in a new intercontinental communication system. As these men of Bell Laboratories and Western Electric continue their round-the-clock program of research and development, they are determined to keep America well ahead in the field of communications. And today they are looking, as all humanity looks, to the vast potentials of outer space.
Hello, this is Cleo, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Accra.
That's a lot of patriotism about a satellite balloon.
About a big Mylar balloon, yeah. So true.
I couldn't imagine like President Obama like doing a rollout of like some new Apple product. So,
you know, right. Like... Yeah. That was one of the first times that it was used as a communication thing. But actually, ham radio operators have been using the moon for a long time, called Earth-Moon-Earth transfers. And for example, I have a link here from a ham radio operator in California who recorded the HARP array in Alaska. He recorded a moon bounce experiment from that. So I'm going to cue that to 722 and then play that. So he'll explain. Here we go. This is K7AGE, a ham radio operator in California.
Lots. 2 seconds on, 3 seconds off. What you hear after it stops transmitting is the signal bouncing off the moon. January 19th, 0537 UTC, TS-2000 Kenwood transceiver 40 meter,
Sorry. So, I don't know if that was clear. Basically, the HAARP array was sending a signal to the moon, and then it was bouncing. So every 2 seconds, they were on, 2 seconds on, and then they would wait for a signal for 3 seconds, I believe, and then 2 seconds on again. So it would sound like beep, 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 and sometimes it would sound beep and then silence or very faint, and then other times it was almost a continuous beep. So like they were getting very strong signals sometimes and weaker signals other times.
So is that from it, like sometimes it hits a smooth spot on the moon and other times it hits a crater?
Yeah, I guess so. It was probably, something like that. Some transmission interference or maybe... Well, it's hard to say that the HAARP array would be aimed wrong, but it could be that the...
Well, it could be a solar flare or something that messing up the ionosphere.
Sure, yeah. But anyway, so that's just to demonstrate that it can, that it really does, you know, happen, and there is some delay, and that there are, ham radio operators would be using it for... Morse code transmissions and sometimes voice as well. So it's also been used in art projects. I have a reading here from a project. It's from it's by Pauline Oliveros in her writings, Sounding the Margins, collected writings from 1992 to 2009. So she did this project called Echoes from the Moon. So I'll just read her writing on this topic, and it's just 3 pages, so it's just a couple minutes of reading. Okay, here it goes. Echoes from the Moon will receive its third performance on September 4th, 1999, at the Hofefest in the city of St. Pölten, Austria. This performance will be a departure from the original work. Sound artist Andreas Bossard will create a moon space in which Pauline Oliveros will play her accordion while interacting with the moon. Her recording and sound will travel via ham radio signal to the moon and return like an echo. The poet Ione will create a text to speak to the moon and help the audience members direct their voices to the moon, creating further echoes. Bossard will use the open radio lines to create his moon space defined by the speaker installation. The audience members will be inside the moon space and hear the music and text created in this large spatial trio and chorus with Oliveros, Ione, Bossard, and themselves. Echoes from the Moon was created in 1987 with support from the National Endowment for the Arts. The idea for the project came to me in 1969 from watching the first lunar landing by the United States astronauts on television. I thought that it would be interesting and poetic for people to experience an installation where they could send the sound of their voices to the moon and hear the echo come back to Earth. They would be vocal astronauts. My first experience of Echoes of the Moon was in New Lebanon, Maine, with ham operator David Olian. He was one of the first HROs to participate in the Moon Bounce project in the 1960s. He and the others sent Morse code to the moon and got it back, which allowed operators to increase the range of their broadcast. I traveled to Maine to work with Dave. He had an array of 24 Yagi antenna that would be aimed at the moon. The moon is in constant motion and has to be tracked by the moving antenna. The antenna have to be large enough to receive the returning signal from the moon. Conditions are constantly changing. Sometimes the signal is lost as the moon moves out of range and has to be found again, and sometimes the signal going to the moon gets lost in galactic noise. I sent my first hello to the moon from Dave's studio in 1987. I stepped on a foot switch to change the antenna from sending to receiving mode, and in 2.5 seconds heard the return hello from the moon. The sound shifted slightly downward in pitch, a Doppler effect caused by the motion of the moon moving relative to Earth, like the whistle of a train as it rushes past. I then played a duo with the moon using a tin whistle, accordion, and a conch shell. I am indebted to Scott Gresham Lancaster, who located Dave Olian for me in 1986 and helped him determine the technology necessary to perform Echoes from the Moon. 10 years later, Scott located all of the ham radio operators for a performance in Hayward, California, which took place during the lunar eclipse on September 23, 1996. Following is the description of that performance. The lunar eclipse from the Hayward Amphitheater was gorgeous. The night was clear and the moon emerged above the trees in an orange mist. As she climbed the sky, her bright sliver emerged slowly from the black shadow, crystal clear. The moon was performing well for us all to see, and now we were ready to sound the moon. The setup for Echoes from the Moon involved Mark Gummer, a ham radio operator from Syracuse, New York, and Scott Gresham Lancaster, the engineer and organizing for the project, Don Roberts, a Seattle area HRO, and Mike Cousins at the Stanford Research Institute in Palo Alto, California, were also involved with the installation. Mark stood by with a 48-foot dish in his backyard. I sent sounds from a microphone in Hayward, California via telephone to Mark, and he, in turn, sent them to the moon with his ham radio gig. 2.5 seconds later, he returned the echo from the moon. The audience cheered as each sound returned to the Hayward University Amphitheater. Later in the evening, Scott set up the installation so that anyone could talk to the moon using a telephone. There was a long line of people of all ages from the audience who participated. People enjoyed hearing their voices moon-processed return. There was a slight Doppler shift on the echo because of the motion of both Earth and the moon. This performance marked the premiere of the installation, Echoes for the Moon, as I originally intended. With this setup, it was only possible to send short phrases of 3 to 4 seconds. The goal of the next installations would be to have continuous feeds for sending and receiving so that it would be possible to play with the moon as a delay line. So that's the end of the reading from the book Sounding the Margins, Collected Writings, 1992 to 2009 by Pauline Oliveros. So it turns out this moon bouncing thing that Pauline was really interested in has become a whole thing. In 2009, there was a World Moon Bounce Day that was started by an international group called Echoes of Apollo, which exists to promote the future of space exploration. And so they founded World Moon Bounce Day, which is a global event where everybody who has a huge array of antennas pointed at the moon and various people communicate over it. So let's see, I'm going to play one of the recording from in a second, but there was another notable event where a data signal was sent from Australia and received in the Netherlands, and it set the world record for the lowest power data signal return from the moon with a transmit power of 3 milliwatts, which they're saying is about 1/1000th of a power of a strong flashlight filament globe. So a tiny amount of power, and they were able to get it halfway around the world. So here's a recording from World Moon Bounce Day. Let's see if I can find it in my list here. World Moon Bounce Day recording, where are you?
No, that's not it.
That's not it. Let's see. I bet you it's here. All right. Are you ready for World Moon Bounce Day recording? It's an interview with an astronaut. The Apollo astronaut Bill Anders was a guest, and so he's interviewed by a ham operator. Here we go.
We're going back to the moon. It won't be a race. It'll be more like exploring Antarctica, something that's worth doing, good for science, but not particularly supported by American or other world taxpayers. My guess is we will probably not have been back to Mars by then. That's an extremely long way, a very dangerous radiation environment, and I really think we need to develop a nuclear rocket capability before we go to Mars. And if we go to Mars, we ought to go as humans, not as jingoistic Americans racing the Chinese or the Russians. Over.
Your Earth-sized photo seems to affect the whole world, and three of time affected you.
Earthrise picture,
gave a kickstart to the environmental movement, and it made me aware, better aware, that the Earth is a very delicate place, but it's also small. We needed to need to learn how to treat it with better care. We also need to know how to get along with each other, because we're just a tiny dust mote in space.
All right, that was a recording from World Moon Bounce Day. That was an astronaut being, the astronaut William Anders being interviewed by a amateur radio society in California. So here's an, I have an example of an artist who has used a moon bounce in a piece. This is Katie Patterson. She has a piece called, ooh, well, I'll just sound over it. So Katie Patterson has this piece that's playing behind called Earth, Moon, Earth, Moonlight Sonata Reflected from the Surface of the Moon.
I'm playing the Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, which she translates into Morse code. Is that what?
Yeah, exactly. So she translated the piece into the score into Morse code and sent it to the moon via this Earth, Moon, Earth, and then the returning to the Earth fragmented it. The transmission was fragmented by the moon's surface, like a craggy surface. So it's been retranslated into a new score, and the gaps and absences becoming intervals and rests in the piece. So the moon altered then score plays on a self-playing grand piano. So that's the Moonlight Sonata, right? So,
right, that's the original or a version of it, yes.
Yeah. So we can play here an excerpt from the resulting piece of it being translated into Morse code, bounced off the moon, recorded, and then retranslated as a piece.
All right, so let's hear
that?
Yeah, let's hear that. Thank you.
It's set up as a loop, so that was it's about 1 minute of it. But you get the idea that it's it's not a complete.
It almost sounded like someone who didn't quite know how to play it, playing
yeah.
it back.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, bouncing things off things in space. I have an example here of meteor echoes. So there's this whole space fence that was set up in order to track satellites in space. So the space fence was basically a wall of transmitted radio that objects orbiting would pass through and send. The radio would bounce off of them and come back down to these receivers. And it was dismantled recently, like last year. But it was a way of tracking orbital debris, meteors, and really anything in space. So there was a live feed from that, which is no longer active because of that. But it's reset up by a different set of operators in Roswell, New Mexico, I believe it is, and they have the same setup bouncing off of a local TV station's transmission. So here's live radio echoes from that. So what you can hear amidst that static, a few pings, and so you have to kind of listen for a long time to hear a lot of them. I could hear a few in that, but we do have here, this is a recording of the International Space Station going through it. So a very big object going through the space fence when it was active, yeah. So yeah, that was the International Space Station being depicted by the space fence. So there's been a lot of, we were playing a few things earlier from the HARP array, and one of the scientists operating or working with the HARP array did an experiment recently where, to experiment with the Luxembourg effect, which is...
Is that the Luxembourg effect there? No.
Yeah, which is where...
What is the Luxembourg effect?
Yeah, it's where radio signals at different frequencies bounce off the ionosphere mixed together. So
there's something like people may have heard with AM radio where you pick up interference in that kind of AM radio way. I mean, it doesn't really happen on FM, but...
I'm not sure what that is or if that's the same thing. This is where the two different musical performances in this case that were transmitted were mixed in space itself. So they're coming together as a whole different thing.
AM frequencies sometimes like bounce off the ionosphere and land in some place where they don't usually receive them. And this would be somebody receiving two signals from somewhere else.
Exactly, that are mixed together, right. And so this is a recording of two different musical performances together. And it's from soundcloud.com, and it's from Hissing Chorus of Dawn. So I'll just play. This is a kind of a long, it's a long piece, so of 27 minutes or so. So I'll play a few minutes of it and then play another. So I'll play like 10 minutes of this.
All right, and then we'll be back shortly on the Saturday afternoon show with Heidi Nielsen.
All right, here we go. Hissing Chorus of Dawn.
It's not quite hissing yet.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to want to hiss for us. All right. We could go to the other thing first while we sort that out.
All right. Is that the John Cage and Sun Ra?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a John Cage and Sun Ra performance from 1986, and it isn't bounced off space. but in this whole business of recording things from space, I've been thinking a bit about John Cage in the sense that it's setting up these parameters and then really listening to static and things that might happen within it. So I thought John Cage and then Sun Ra, because it's Sun Ra.
Well, he came from space, so I guess it is bouncing from that way.
Yeah, it is bouncing from space, so it completely makes sense. So here's John Cage meets Sun Ra, side A. From 1986.
Thank you. Thank you.
it's a selection from John Cage meets Sun Ra from Ubu Web. And here we have Hissing Chorus of Dawn, Harpere, Luxembourg Effect Test, where two songs are mixed in space.
Thank you.